Good evening.
Hard times, and I don't have any magic. Except we have a superpower. I don't know if you read Ruth Ozeki's book, A Tale for a Time Being. There's a young girl from Japan. She's having a hard time in school. And partly because she was raised in the United States and the other kids think that she's weird. So she goes to visit her grandmother, who is a nun up in the mountains, and her grandmother teaches her a superpower. And what is it? Zazen. So that's our superpower. And we need it right now. I don't know if you could say if this is doctrinally correct, but we need it desperately. So I'm glad we sat together. And I don't usually think of in terms of titles for my talks, but this one has one. And it is, what is the Bodhisattva to do? What are we to do? It's a big question. And we need to answer it, I believe. It's not enough right now to say, I feel helpless. Or, I'm not a racist. We all have homework to do. And I think we're all racists. Most of us, not overt racists, but we all grew up here. And this country has a deep wound, hundreds of years old. And it corrupts us. And people of color, we say that the way it's better described is that they often internalize the racism. I have a friend it's just hard to imagine what I'm about to say. I want to cry. I have a friend that he's married to my cousin, and he and I are great friends. He's a little older than I am. And he's African-American, and he's pretty dark. And his mother had a couple of different fathers for his siblings. And his other siblings, especially his brother, is relatively light-skinned. And his mother treated him badly and treated his brother well. She favored his brother beyond some sort of relatively normal thing. She was prejudiced against her own kid. And that sort of thing happens. And I am a privileged white person. So I have my homework to do. And I can't, should not, will not expect people of color to educate me. I appreciate it when they do. But it's not their job. It's my job and your job, most of you. And it's all of our job to educate ourselves. So what's the Bodhisattva about? You know, they're supposed to stick around and be useful, even though they could take final nirvana. And they Their practice grows out of emptiness. Buddha taught emptiness. No thing. Not to be attached to anything. Nothing has own being. Bodhisattvas don't have own being. And unlike us, they know it. They know that there's no thing, nothing to hold on to, only change. They also know there's nothing but interconnection. Nothing but interconnection. And that's something to remember, we bodhisattvas. We set up I, you, us, them. We make people other. We do it subconsciously. And consciously. The bodhisattvas know interconnection. They know fearlessness. What does that mean for us? That's a whole other lecture. I'm not particularly going there, but it's being willing to be afraid and not have that fear overwhelm us. Sometimes I say not. I work not to be afraid of my own fear. And not to act from it. And a bodhisattva knows something about that. If there are such amazing bodhisattvas like Avalokiteshvara say, maybe they don't know fear. I don't know. Not being Avalokiteshvara quite yet. But she knows about my fear. And Jizo knows about my fear. So they certainly know it. And they know compassion. Buddha taught compassion. Dogen teaches compassion. Suffering with. Feeling with. Calm with. Passion. Often translated, the root I think comes from suffering. So I think of it as strong feeling, strong emotion often. But at any rate, bodhisattvas come from that. They're not living in la-la land, in the heavenly realm of emptiness and bliss. They're here in the marketplace with us. And the only way, I think, is to have that compassion and that understanding that I believe that they have and that we have and we're capable of, is to really understand it. To really understand the suffering of ourselves and others. I noticed you said something about, not that you were going to be working not just with COVID-19, but with other things. And last Saturday we had a memorial service for all the people who have died from the plagues, plural, that beset us, and named them as COVID and poverty, which is love. Caused a lot of unnecessary deaths from the COVID virus. And police violence against people of color. And we couldn't even name all the COVID names. I did the math, and it was substantially over 100,000 deaths by then. So I came out with about 550 people each one reciting 200 names. 550 people, each reciting 200 names, would have done it then. It's not enough now. That, just imagine that. 550 people. And the names of people who have died at the hands of police, people of color who have died at the hands of police. It's also a lot. It's many, and so we named the more recent ones as representatives of others. But we, bodhisattvas, need to understand what is going on. Why are these people, those people, why are these people so angry? What is this anger about? I'm not asking, why are these people so angry in the tone of voice that says, I don't know why they're all looting and burning and complaining about the police. Why are they so angry? I know a lot about why people are angry. I'm angry. And we bodhisattvas, wanting to understand, need to educate ourselves. When I was a kid in the 50s, early 60s, when I was growing up, you know, I actually had friends whose mothers would ask the cleaning lady or the maid what all the trouble was about and whether she had any problems. And guess what? The cleaning lady thought those marches and sit-ins were just terrible. And she would never do anything like that. No, everything was fine. And then these mothers would repeat this to their daughters. And we would laugh. But it wasn't funny. And I suppose we've come a little way, because I think that would be a rare event now. I don't know. But at any rate, I'm working to educate myself. And I've learned a lot in the last couple of years that I didn't know before. I read Jill Lepore's book, In These Truths, which is a history of the United States in one volume. And she talks a lot about slavery and the aftermath of slavery. But one of the things she talks about is how all during the time of slavery, there were lots of revolts and lots of fights. And so, you know, I heard of that term. And it was common. As well it should have been. But I didn't know that. Now I do. And I know more details about slavery. It's less of a cartoon. One of the things that Lepore, she's a writer for the New Yorker, she's a well-regarded historian and author and so on, so I believe her. She said that 9 of George Washington's false teeth were provided by pulling them out of his slave's mouth. 9 of his teeth. I knew he had false teeth. I knew that they were probably not ivory and probably were wood. But I didn't know that he allowed or asked for, I don't know what his exact involvement was, but he must have known. They don't look like wooden teeth. They were pulled out of his slave's mouth. And when his will, when he died, bequeathed all of his slaves to his wife, Martha, for her life, and then they were to be freed. So she lived in fear for the rest of her life that somebody was going to murder her, which is a reasonable fear, I think, for her to have. And my book group, bless them, bunch of lefty lawyers, so we read serious books, which is good. And so we read, The Underground Railroad, which I think is a good picture. So many of the slave novels and all, you know, tend to be more about house slaves than about what it was like to be in the fields. Lepore writes about it. These people were field fodder, say. Just worked to death and then replaced. We've read Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me, and We Were 8 Years in Power. And he's writing about his own experience, and he also writes about history. He has a famous essay, as a, I guess a cover essay in the Atlantic 6 years ago about reparations, and I have not yet read it. I've always meant to read it. So I say to you, and I'm actually, I found it and I have it. I have it now on my iPhone, and I can either read it or listen to it. Trevor Noah, you may have heard recently, last week, I think, had I guess, you know, he was part of his show, but it wasn't comedy. It was like a, you know, an essay. And he was talking about what's been going on and how angry people are. Think about COVID and the fact that people of color die at a much higher rate. And finally, I'm just sort of listing things, but I saw, I guess it was today, a video that somebody on my next door list posted. And I want you to know, on my next door, in Malibu, it's been quite thoughtful, the discussion. I've been very happy to be part of it. Not everybody agrees and so on, and people occasionally say, you know, I'm not a racist at all. But it's been almost entirely useful and supportive. And the finger turning this way, this way. So this video, and I've forgotten the young woman's name, but I'll say, if you're interested, you can ask me and I'll send you a link to it on YouTube. She's a young African-American woman, and she's talking about why people are angry and how we should understand looting. She doesn't do the sort of, yes, people are very upset because they've been mistreated for hundreds of years and redlined out of housing and didn't get access to the GI Bill and education and they didn't get access to the GI housing benefits and so on and so on and so on and so on. No, she says, we have to ask ourselves why. And I think it's a really useful question for bodhisattvas. Why are people so angry? And, oh, I know Trevor Noah talked about how there is a social contract, and the social contract that we're all supposed to have signed is that if you call the police, they'll come. And if you break the law, then you're going to pay the penalty. And if you don't break the law, you won't. And that social contract works reasonably well for white people, not so well for very poor white people, but this, I can only talk about one thing at a time. But so, and it doesn't work for black people. Trevor Noah kept saying, we didn't sign it. Or, you know, it doesn't work for us. It doesn't apply for us. There is no social contract. There's a contract on people of color. I don't think he said that, but I'm going to say it. And so, in this video, this young woman talks about that, about how there is no social contract. And people have been denied jobs and health care and education, and they wind up poor and afraid every time they go out the door and having to sort of accommodate to white culture. And suffer poor health conditions because of poverty and difficulty getting care. I imagine you know that black people's pain is not treated the same as white people's pain. At any rate, that's true. And she talks about how she has a great analogy about as if we were playing Monopoly. And there's a white, a person representing white and a person representing black people. And for the first 200 years, the white person has all the money and all the pieces and everything, and the black person doesn't have anything and really can't even play. And then at some point, things change, and the black person can get some money, but every time they get something, they have to give it to the white person. And then finally, after, 300-400 years, the black person is able to play and keep the money. And the white person says, okay, now there's a level playing field. Just catch up. After having been playing with all the advantages for 400 years. Wouldn't you be pissed off? And she talks about the race massacres, which perhaps you've heard of. When some black communities began to thrive and have their own entrepreneurial groups and their own businesses and make some money and have, you know, nice homes and so on, like as in Tulsa. Tulsa was, I think, called the Wall Street of the Midwest or something, or the Black Wall Street. Anyway, the whites decided they were too uppity, so they came in and just massacred people and burned homes and drove the people out of town. And she also mentions another place, a similar kind of thing, called Roseville. And I sent this video to a bunch of people, and a friend wrote back and he said, I Googled it because I hadn't heard about Tulsa. And I found out that there were four or five more. there's so much that we don't know, I think. I mean, you may know all of these things, you may know some of them. You probably know because of the movement to topple the Confederate statues. Those statues were erected when the Civil Rights Movement started to take off in this country. When Jim Crow was kind of fading, then they erected these statues. They're not there from the Civil War. They have a different message. These are things I'm learning. And I am trying to be the kind of bodhisattva that, you know, takes the finger and points it to myself. You know, Dogen says to study the Buddha way is to study the self. Buddha says, this is this way because that's that way. Thich Nhat Hanh says, there's a child prostitute in Manila because there's a banker in Switzerland. So I have my piece of this that I've learned through osmosis. You know, my parents were not overtly racist. They were liberal Adlai Stevenson Democrats. But they were raised in it, and they had some vestiges. Not to mention, I grew up here. I grew up here. And my father once said, I mean, this I thought was very admirable. He said that he had real, through college, he used to say, he grew up, his mother was like a British colonial and very British colonial. And at any rate, he used to say, that's right, white of you, old man, to his friends when they did something that he liked. And finally, one day in college, it dawned on him what he was saying. So he stopped saying it. But that was a perfectly fine thing to say in his generation. So maybe things have gotten a little better, I guess. But I need to look at this one. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. And Dogen did not mean just self. What is the self? Do you have a self? No, I don't. Where can you find a self? Is it in your fingers? All that. No. Yes, he meant that. But he also meant to take a look at your own nitty-gritty habits of mind. Habits of heart, maybe. So that's what I work on. I've been working on it for a long time, and I'm rededicating myself to working on it. Now, when I see a big, relatively young black man coming towards me on the sidewalk, especially one who doesn't look middle class and nerdy, you know, I get a little tightness. And I don't want to deny it. I don't want to pretend that doesn't happen. And my practice nowadays is to, if I'm walking, keep walking or whatever, but to look at the person in the eye and say, hi. And guess what? They say, hi. And maybe, how you doing? I know that that little catch is something that white women have been the word that's coming is trained, but it's more like conditioned. That's a conditioned response growing up in this culture. We're afraid of each other. I've been told that Vallejo police don't live here because they're afraid to live in the community. Well, maybe with good reason, given how Vallejo police traditionally treat people of color. You know, our police department is about to be investigated by the Attorney General. that I have my own racism that I am working on, and I am ashamed. And I work with being kind to myself in the process, because there's a human tendency. If someone makes you feel ashamed, then you hate them. And I know that, so I tend not to go that way, but it's just, that is just human nature. So I might, we're here to doing a class or reading Pema Chodron's When Things Fall Apart as a way to talk about nowadays. So this is our slogan. Take a kindly, friendly interest. But do take it. So I'm going to stop talking. I hope this is useful to you, and if you want to see that video, which is, she swears, and she's very angry. But she really, you can feel the why of it. Anyhow, okay, I'm sorry. So if you have a question or a comment, do I call on people, Zorli, or do you, or what?
Well, you may call on people, and I'll also be trying to pay attention. Everybody understands that you can raise your hand and unmute yourself. And was this?
Okay, do that, you guys. Raise your hand and unmute yourself. And remember, there's, I don't know if there are people beyond what I see on my screen, but I see about, I don't know, 27, 28 people altogether. So,
Yes. I think everybody's on the screen, and some people are not, have their video on. So,
yes, I see that.
Their hand won't be raised, so those people should just speak up.
Yeah, if you want to unmute yourself, we'll see the little red thing go away.
Yeah.
And remember, there aren't any stupid questions or stupid comments. The only stupid thing is not to say what is in your heart.
Oscar's raised his hand.
But so did Jim. I saw you first. How about Jim and then Oscar?
Okay.
Thank you, Mary, for your talk and your reflections on this moment. I watched that video that you referenced, and I commend it to people with, the caution that, there is a lot of anger, and there's it's coming from the street, so it's coming from, that difficult situation right in the Black community. And, probably for us to just experience that anger, just and like, be open to it, just let it happen and see, and just feel how we react to it and see what kind of things come up in relation to that kind of anger. It's probably useful. It's probably a useful thing. But, it is kind of also shocking. So you just have to notice what's going on for yourself. I think that's the useful thing. And I watched another video that Linda sent me, which was, had a very different tone, but was very powerful. And that was a video of Stephen Colbert speaking with Cory Booker a day or so after one U.S. Senator stopped an anti-lynching bill from being approved in the Senate.
It was Rand Paul.
Yeah, that was Rand Paul who stopped the bill from being approved. Cory Booker had a very impassioned statement on the floor of the Senate. And then in this interview, he was with Colbert, he was, he was calm. And I felt like it was, anyway, there's so much out there now to see and to listen to. And anyway, I want to make myself clear that it's well worth listening to Cory Booker's interview with Stephen Colbert. I think it's a half an hour, but it's really worth listening to. And when you listen to it, you'll probably say, maybe we should have paid a little bit more attention to him as a presidential candidate, because I think his extremely well spoken and thoughtful and passionate at the same time, and also really speaks from the standpoint of love, which we're seeing a lot of anger in this moment, but we're also seeing a lot of love, and I think that's important to realize too at this time. So I don't really have a question, Mary. That's a thank you for bringing this up and having this conversation.
So the video is raw, and a lot of I sent it to a bunch of people, some of the teacher groups and so on, and I got back responses that people said I cried when I watched it. So I think it's useful. It's all useful. And I think a bodhisattva's love is deeply important. And that's what underlies educating ourselves, understanding. And it's got to include kindly interest and love for yourself, of course. But it's time. It's time. Where, there you are, Oscar.
Yeah, Oscar.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary. I also appreciated your talk very much. And I got the impression, Mary, that this is that before this particular point in time, which is of really unusual feeling that's in the country, I got the impression you've been doing, from what you said, that you've been doing race work and privilege work for some time. And if that's true, I wonder when that began for you, and was there any particular, and how that came about? Was there any particular experience?
I don't know. I mean, you grow up in a sort of liberal, progressive. I mean, my mother joined the ACLU when it was first founded. It was during McCarthy's time. And but she just thought they were saying good things. So she was a Swedish young woman from Duluth, Minnesota, who went to LA. She was teaching elementary school, but she just thought that was right, so she joined it. But that, I was not among us yet. But I feel like I absorbed an awareness of it as an issue growing up. The first thing I really remember is going to Sunday school. I must have been about 16, 17 years old, and one of the leaders there, this was a theosophy school, was teaching kind of more like a Hindu idea of karma and reincarnation, whatever, that my family had gotten involved with. Anyway, I was there as a young person, and one of the leaders, a woman, was talking about going to get a Christmas tree and going to a Christmas tree lot, and she said, Yeah, there was this young nigger boy who was telling us to go, and I just was absolutely shocked, and I'll never forget it. And I stopped going. I just didn't want to be part of that. And so that's a major thing. And I, you know, my mother was very active in, what is it? The Fair, establishing the Fair Housing Commission. I forget what it's called in California. But she was one of the people that was really pushing for that. So it's, you know, it's been around, but I don't know, I don't, so yes, as an issue, but looking at my own racism is more recent. But it's hard for me to put a date on it. It's certainly been a long time. Yes, Carolyn? You need to unmute yourself. There you go.
This week, you may not have noticed that Amazon actually has, if you look at Amazon Prime Movies, that they have a whole, they've said, you know, Black Lives Matter, and they have selected a great number of movies all around Black history that are phenomenal, and many of them they usually charge for, but they're all free. So Chuck and I watched An Unconventional Truth last night, and it is profound if you have not watched it, but it really is. It starts out with this man saying that his family was part of starting racism, and he was told as a kid growing up that they used to have 100 slaves, and that when the Civil War ended, they told the slaves that they could leave or they could stay and they would pay them, and only a few people left. What he really found out as time went on is they really only had 6 slaves, and they all left except one. And part of his story was finding the grave. And I'm just telling more than I wanted to tell about this, but it was a great learning experience to fill in some of the gaps of work I've already done. And this is very hard work. And I'm so glad that, Doralee, you brought this up, that this continues to be a topic that we need to discuss as a group. And I want you to know, I don't like doing it. I just do not like doing it. I mean, I know I'm right there as you're talking about, I'm a racist. I know I'm a racist. I know I've had so many privileges from being white. You know, I mean, I have been blessed by being white. And that is so hard for me to look at and to keep looking at it. And Chuck and I have been, you know, every time there was an opportunity to go to a workshop on diversity, we've gone. I think our first experience was 20 years ago that we were at this couples conference on how to do couples therapy. And they had one seminar on diversity, and Chuck and I went. I want you to know there were about 300, 400 people at the conference. There were 6 people in this workshop. This is such a hard topic because, as you say, because it's all about me, and I want to make it, okay, we covered it, it's time to go on to something else, but The world is really showing us we can't go on to something else. No, this is about healing ourselves and healing our brothers and sisters, and we need to do this work, and it is horrible, ugly work, and I want to thank you for your talk tonight and what we're about.
Okay, and don't forget, you know, this is what one of the things Emma talks about, you know, if you just criticize yourself, and don't have some lightness here and there, you'll burn out, you'll stop, or you'll hate yourself and turn into a total jerk to yourself and everybody else, you know. So Yes, I completely agree with you. It's the pits doing this work. But considering, we really have to. Anybody else? Oh, I'm sorry.
Let me get this. One day, I was actually at a gas station, and this young black fellow was at the gas station filling up his gas tank, and it was just, I apologized to him. I apologized for everything that he'd been through, and I wanted him to know, and I wanted him to at least have had one old white lady apologize to him for what he had gone through. And, you know, that's part of, at least in my mind, part of the work I need to do. So, thank you for allowing me to share here.
Mm-hmm. Dorley?
Well, yeah, this is a very important issue for me, and we've had some gatherings in our Sangha to explore this in the last couple of years, but I wish we had something more ongoing. Because to really look at ourselves in these ways you're talking about and I've talked about, you know, takes a special kind of development of trust and gentleness, and I don't know. I'm just putting it out there in case others might be interested in a kind of small group exploration of our white fragility, our white privilege.
You know, there is a book group that is led by Chris Fortin and Sarah Emerson.
Yes.
Everyday Zen, and Sarah's from Stone Creek. And it's online now, for, you know, totally. And they not, it's not just books, so they, I think they've called it something else now. Like a study group on racial matters. I don't know. Anyway, if you, I can send you a link, or if you know how to contact them, just contact them.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think that it's open. We were talking about doing it, and then things just got overwhelming, and we were going to study the American Sutra as our class this spring, but it just got, there was so much pain already that we switched to Pema, but we will do it. We'll probably do it next spring. You know, because the American Sutra is about how Buddhists were treated, Japanese Buddhists were treated during World War II. But I don't know if I recommend reading it. It's pretty hard. Anyway, but you could look into that. And if you guys want to do your own, then you could, you know, just get suggestions from them about things to read.
Great. Oh, any more like thoughts or questions?
Oh, Karen? Did I see Karen? Did I see?
Yes. Thank you, Mary, for your talk and. It's been on all of our minds, I know, a lot already, but you're saying that, you know, the work of the Bodhisattva is, I think you said something about fearlessness I don't think it's really, I don't know, I guess I think of it more in terms of courage. Having the courage to look and receive and I was remembering my own childhood, which was one of my strongest memories, early memories, with my grandfather, who was quite racist and hateful. And yet I thought, well, how can my grandfather is loving, you know? How could he be both loving and so hateful to these other people? And growing up, then I really didn't have the courage to then to talk about it, but I think it would be useful for, I think anyway, a lot of people maybe to talk about some of those kinds of experiences and learn how to be, be more courageous.
That is a better word. Thank you.
And one other thing, I read something recently, I don't know what it was, but it was, I mean, I don't know where it was, and the words were, love is not an emotion, love is a decision. And I've been thinking about that lately, on both the personal level and but a societal level too. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just throwing that out.
Good. You reminded me, sort of tangentially, there's something, you know, I work with lawyers a lot, and lawyers work with anger a lot. And one of the things we often talk about is, you know, anger is fine. If anger arises, it's okay. And we don't want to act from it. We don't want to act it out. We don't want to harbor ill will and let it fester. Or hang on to it and wallow in it. But the first, when it arises, you need to allow it to arise, abide, and pass away in your body. So it doesn't poison you or other people. However, there are times when you need to be fierce. And I guess I'd say too that bodhisattvas need to be fierce sometimes. Sometimes you have to say, no, sometimes you set boundaries. Sometimes you speak up if you hear somebody else say or do something racist. I think that's a useful concept, that there are times when you really need to be fierce. Being a bodhisattva is not just being sort of, oh, look at this, so nice. No.
I think Oscar has his hand up. Oscar.
Okay. I just was looking to see if there anybody who hasn't spoken yet that had their hand up. Yes, not. Please, Oscar.
Thank you. This discussion prompts me to remember that there's a lot of discussion happening now about the intersections of race injustice, social injustice, and also environmental degradation. It's an interesting topic, because I think, you know, well, it all comes back to greed and hate and delusion. Anyway, in the climate, I'm involved with some people who are doing climate action work, and there's a great deal of determination that climate work needs to involve also social justice work and although there was a lot of theoretical understanding of this COVID situation and the discrepancies in mortality rates among different zip codes really brought home how stressors in the environment are, how climate change will be a threat multiplier, which will affect most severely those who are always affected by disasters. So, moving forward, there are opportunities to. In the next year or two, to integrate justice planning into climate adaptation planning at the local level. So I'm kind of happy to report that. I can't say I'm happy to report it. It's something that needs to be done, and so I hope it gets done.
Well, there's Earth Justice, And Vallejo is a poster child. So far we've succeeded, but because it's a relatively poor town and a lot of, you know, we're the, one of the most diverse cities in the country, a lot of African-Americans, a lot of Asians, a lot of Filipinos mostly, and Hispanics. And when I first got here, there was a plan that the city council really liked to bring a liquid natural gas plant right to the tip of Mare Island, where there just happens to be a lot of unexploded ordnance yet. And that was fought back. And then more recently, there was a proposal to locate a big cement plant right on the edge of the entrance to the Napa River at the Cartagena Strait. And it would have been basically bordering the black ghetto right near an elementary school with, I forget how many trucks coming and going 24 hours a day, like 200 or something like that. And that seems to have been successfully watched, but that's the intersection. And of course, Solano County is the asthma capital, one of the asthma capitals of California. So they're totally related. Okay, it's almost 8:30. Is there any final burning desire, as we say? Sarah?
Oh, has her hand up.
Hi, Mary, I don't know if other people heard this, and this is slightly tangential, but I think looking to other people to be our teachers, I don't know if anybody heard the mayor of Atlanta and the impromptu speech that she made to her community as the riots began to break out. She's newly elected this year. She's an African-American woman, and I was just so inspired by the way she took control. The very first thing she said, George, that's her son, if you're still out on the street, I want you to go home. And she spoke like a mother. And her message was love and anger at the same time. And she said, Atlanta, we're better than this. We're better than this. And I was just so impressed by her leadership and her passion and her ability to bring calm to her community. It was 10 minutes. But if anyone, I think she was such an inspiration to me as a way to that role of the mother in taking care of her family, getting her son home off the street, and then appealing to people's better nature. We're better than this. So I don't know if other people, but I think she's an inspiring role model as to how to deal with that kind of anger. And she's obviously in the center of it as the mayor and as a black woman.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, may I hear the last one?
It wasn't for me. It was Richard had his hand up at the same time that Sarah's did.
Oh, okay.
And now his picture's gone. I'm not sure he still wants to speak. There he is. Richard had his hand up.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi, Richard.
I just wanted to say thank you for the talk and the video that you talked about. I was saying, yes, the anger in the video even touched me. I agree with you where it feels like it gives you that feel of the why.
Yeah.
Like very strongly, and yeah, I would say yeah, caution. But I think I talked to my wife last week, and you know, it just came out of me. But I told her, I said, if you, I guess as a person of color, if you have at one point in your life as a younger person thought, oh, it'd be better if I just burn it down, then you haven't felt, I guess, fair and unjust or injustice. And I think that video promptly gives you that feeling of despair and anger to a very strong degree. So, yeah, very caution, but it does give a why. Thank you for the talk and bringing that up.
Thank you. Thank you for speaking. I've been aware of you and thinking, wondering how it was for you. So I appreciate your saying something.
Can I?
All right. You're the last one. Really, really,
just really briefly. I've watched both the Cory Booker and Latrice's, Kimberly Latrice Jones's, multiple times in the last 2 days, and I think they're perfect examples of appropriate responses, which is what Zen is all about, completely different ways of responding, but to me both totally appropriate to the time and the place.
Okay.
I'm finished.
Okay. So I don't know if you want to let me know or Doralee, could I send you a link to that video and you could put it on the cover or something? And then...
Sure. Send it. That's fine.
Okay.
So maybe we can have the after lecture, yeah. Hand Oscar.